Ladies and gentlemen, our first case for argument this morning is New West against the City of Joliet. Mr. Hecht.
Your Honor, my name is Thomas Hecht. I represent the appellant here, New West. If it pleases the court, this is a case which has a good many issues in it, but at its core, this is a case about what claims can be asserted when a municipality systematically undertakes to eliminate a federally funded housing program in order to exclude African Americans. That is the allegation of the complaint, although it manifests itself in a number of different areas. That, at its core, is what this case is about. The district court concluded that New West, my client, cannot challenge these acts of discrimination, this abuse.
The relation between this claim and the condemnation action, which the city has filed and I gather also has been removed. Why was this case decided independently of the city's condemnation action?
Because I think, Your Honor, this case raises issues that are not present in the eminent domain proceeding. The eminent domain proceeding, the condemnation action that was removed.
The proceeding succeeds. It looks to me like there's nothing here. And if I gather that both cases are pending before the same district judge.
That's correct.
So why was the condemnation action delayed pending this rather than the two being consolidated or the condemnation decided first?
I don't have an answer to that. Those issues...
I hope you see my problem. It looks like the issues that are being argued here are entirely theoretical.
Well, I don't think that they're entirely theoretical. We have very serious claims here under the Fair Housing Act, which were presented in the complaint. We have very serious claims.
If the city condemns and takes over the project, what's the claim under the Fair Housing Act?
Well, that would be an independent claim. The New West is certainly entitled to seek recovery, seek relief for the acts of discrimination that are contained within the allegations under the Fair Housing Act. And similarly, it would be able to do so under 1982 and 1983.
I don't understand that, counsel. And the argument, as I understand your Fair Housing Act claim, is that the city has done something that's discouraged tenants from buying apartments in this project and thus reduce your client's income. If the project is condemned and taken over by the city, your client's income stream is zero. Your client's just cashed out.
But that doesn't obviate the damages that have incurred to date under the Fair Housing Act or under the civil rights statutes.
Let me ask you another question. I know that there were two closings on Evergreen Terrace, and
that's
the first
right.
one took place in November of 06. What's going on with respect to the second one?
There is a second closing. I believe it's scheduled for some time this fall. It has not yet been completed, and those issues still remain before us. And actually, that is one of the reasons why we believe the claim of Joliet that the case is moot is incorrect.
Yeah, I knew that was the status as of the time the briefs were filed. I just wanted an update as to whether that second one had occurred.
Right, that continues to be the status of the two cases. As you know, we brought a suit to challenge the actions of Joliet under three...
One more clarification. What actions are you challenging other than the filing of the condemnation action? Lobbying with HUD?
There are a number of actions that are being challenged.
What else?
I'm sorry?
There's the filing of the condemnation proceeding. There's lobbying with HUD. What else concretely?
There is direct harassment of tenants to frighten and intimidate them. And
what does that mean concretely?
It means concretely acts to discourage tenants. It means
an example
racial
of the act. That's what it means to ask for something concretely.
I understand that, Your Honor. The specific acts would be the threats of closing the property, the threats that you will not have an apartment here, an effort to create a climate of fear.
So it's just the thing they have said to tenants is, we're filing a condemnation action, we're going to raise the project.
I think that that's in part what they say to the tenants, but they also...
Is there anything else concretely that they have said?
Yes, there are concrete actions with respect to New West and communications to HUD and the use of fraudulent and intentionally deceptive statements about the condition of the property.
But I'm asking for you to be concrete. Could you tell me what they are?
Yes. In meetings with HUD, Joliet wrongfully, knowing it was wrongfully.
Maybe I'm just not clear.
Me too. Lobbying
with HUD is thoroughly protected by the North Pennington Doctrine. There's no conceivable liability for lobbying with HUD. The question I'm asking you is, other than lobbying with HUD, what concretely has been said that might reach the ears of tenants? Now, one thing is we're filing a condemnation action and this project is going to be dynamited. What else?
In statements directly to HUD. This is a...
Stop. No statements directly to HUD. I want to know what they have said, not in the form of lobbying to HUD.
Well, I disagree with that statement that it's a form of lobbying. I think it's a more aggressive, assertive set of acts than that. There are, in addition to those statements, there is the submission of an fraudulent alternative plan for affordable housing designed only to forestall HUD's approval process, which led to long delays and adversely affected New West's costs.
Is this something that was said to HUD or was said to the tenants?
This was said to HUD.
Okay. Is there anything that was said to the tenants or done to the tenants other than letting the tenants know that the city has filed a condemnation action?
I can't give you any more specific information than that. It's a matter in which we have pleaded that these acts, the statements of we're going to take these units away, you're not going to have places to live, is part of a climate that the city of Joliet created. And more specific than that, at this stage of the proceeding, we do not know.
Well, at this stage of the proceeding, as the Supreme Court said yesterday in Bell Atlantic, you have to have made available enough to have a plausible claim. And if all you've got is a claim that the city told the tenants it was going to condemn the property, which one might think the city would have to, it can't hide that fact, and that they've told HUD they want them out of this, it doesn't seem you've got any plausible claim.
No, I think that I disagree with that respectfully. I think that both Shake and I think the Progress Development Corp against Mitchell both articulate claims in circumstances that are closely comparable to this. In addition to the eminent domain proceeding, once Joliet learned of HUD's desire to preserve Evergreen Terrace, it not only did it repeatedly threaten to seize the property, but it also initiated a series of sham transactions. Once it knew that HUD was proceeding to a closing and that its efforts to derail those proceedings.
Actions.
There are a series of claims filed, including actions for code enforcement that follow, two actions for code enforcement and a demolition proceeding, which followed the knowledge of Joliet that HUD was going to proceed to closing and, in fact, was going to renew its relationship with Evergreen Terrace and that Evergreen Terrace was going to continue despite the efforts of Joliet to derail that its presence. You know, for years, as the complaint articulates, for years there were never any problems necessitating that kind of activity by Joliet. It's only, and indeed, shortly prior to the filing of these actions, Joliet's building and fire department gave Evergreen Terrace a clean bill of health. Those acts, those sham transactions, were a part of an effort to derail the renewal of Evergreen Terrace and are as much a part of the array of activity in which Joliet engaged, as is the eminent domain proceeding, as are the intimidating statements to tenants, as is the submission of a fraudulent plan for alternative housing with the idea of derailing HUD and delaying the approval.
In terms of timing, you mentioned that Evergreen Terrace there were no violations, you know, prior to this indication that HUD was going to renew.
Yes.
Give me the specific dates of that, you know, just in terms of the timeline.
Sure. In mid 2002, HUD and New West undertake the preliminary discussions to renew the project. Joliet gets wind of that and begins its campaign to derail that. That continues up to the first, that sort of preliminary, up to the first commitment, which is in May of 2003.
But when they get the clean bill of health, that's what I want to know. When was
that? That clean bill of health happens in 04 and I think 05, although I have to defer to what we said in the briefs about that. I believe it's in 03. There are, in addition to that, certifications by Joliet prior to the imposition of this array of litigation that the project complied with all appropriate building and other code standards. It's only once the tempo of the refinancing, the tempo of the preservation area effort picks up that Joliet goes into high gear and really begins the process of threatening to take the property, intimidating the tenants, undertaking sham transactions, all with the purpose of derailing this activity and derailing HUD from its expressed intent to preserve affordable housing at this site and to renew its refinancing with Evergreen Terrace. And it almost succeeds. At various points in time, HUD imposes extensive delays on the process, which has the effect, of course, of increasing the financing costs to New West, increasing the cost of renovation, and it works with the tenants. The tenants begin to leap.
You know, counsel, and I have something of a background in antitrust law. My reaction is I've heard all of this before. This was exactly the line of argument made in the Norr Pennington cases, that lobbying and intervention with a governmental agency increased people's costs and drove them out of business. The Supreme Court held that not only is there no such claim substantively, but that activity of that kind is affirmatively protected by the First Amendment. The city has a right to tell HUD anything it wants, and the federal judiciary can't say to the city, shut up, don't contact this federal agency.
But it does not have a right to provide fraudulent and deceptive information. That is
actually
not a protected person.
Actually, that's the holding of Norr. The Court of Appeals in Norr had said, but the information is false and fraudulent. And the Supreme Court's reversed and said it doesn't matter whether the information provided to the federal agency is false and fraudulent.
I think that on this motion to dismiss, this adjudication, the array of material from whether it be fraudulent statements, whether it be the promulgation of...
Counsel, is there any way you can distinguish the Norr Pennington cases?
Well, there
As
is
I
in
say,
one respect.
That is the holding of Norr Pennington.
But Norr Pennington also recognizes an exception for sham transactions, and that fits precisely within the kind of transactions that are alleged to have... the kind of sham lawsuits that are alleged to have happened here.
Counsel, what is... the sham transactions? Again, could you be concrete?
I did not mean to use the word transaction. I meant the sham filings of building code violation cases and the demolition proceeding that was also filed when it became apparent that HUD was going to proceed to a closing with New West.
What is the status of these building code enforcement proceedings?
We asked that they be stayed by the state courts. That motion was denied. Those are currently have been consolidated and are on appeal.
They're on appeal. What happened in the trial court then?
The motion to stay was denied, and under Illinois law, there is an interlocutory appeal under from denials of motions to stay.
I'm a little puzzled. If they are sham lawsuits, a sham lawsuit is a suit that's transparently and ridiculously frivolous. Why did you ask that they be stayed rather than dismissed as transparently and ridiculously frivolous?
Because we thought we made a choice to proceed in front of Judge Norgel rather than take on the burdens of motions to dismiss in the district court, in the trial courts in the state proceeding.
Choice. Given younger, just to let's litigate everything in federal court. All right, go ahead.
Let me say just a few words about 1982 and 1983 claims we also asserted. With regard to 1983, the district court concluded that since no Monell claim had been pleaded, the action couldn't survive. That conclusion from the district court ignored the fact that individual officers were sued in their individual capacities and that, therefore, the standards of Monell didn't apply.
That's to them individually, though, so you concede,
yes,
what you concede with respect to the city of Joliet.
No, I don't concede,
that
actually.
Monell, that you didn't meet the Monell standards.
We certainly did not plead a Monell pattern and practice, mm-hmm, in the complaint. And to that extent, Your Honor is right. But we did. The defendants here include the mayor, the city manager, and the deputy city manager. We think that Joliet was, in fact, a proper defendant under this court's ruling in Brokaw versus Mercer County. They were the final policymakers for directing the administrative effort to kill Evergreen Terrace. And in such circumstances, where the final policymakers, the final decision makers, control the events at issue, it's presumed to be an act of the municipality.
Well, one of the things that you point to is their authorization of this lawsuit, but, you know, how does the filing of the lawsuit rise to the level of a constitutional deprivation required under 1983 to show liability under 1983?
Well, I think it's an array of actions taken by Joliet. It's not just the filing of the lawsuit. It's the defendant's authorization of the harassment of tenants. It's the efforts to derail HUD's continued expressed agreement to close on these transactions.
Right. But with respect to the filing of the lawsuit, do you concede that that does not rise to the level of a 1983 violation? I understand there are other factors. I just want to focus on the lawsuit right
now. And which of the – which we're dealing, unfortunately, with the number of lawsuits here. Which one do
you – Well, we've got the condemnation lawsuit, and we've got all these violations.
Yes, we've got actually four lawsuits,
mm-hmm,
at issue here.
Yeah, there are two others.
Yes.
Do any of those, do you think, rise to a constitutional violation?
Yes, and I think they do. I think because I think you look at the intent behind these sham filings, and I think that whether that relates to the eminent domain proceeding or to the demolition action or to the sort of discovered building code violation actions, all of those, given the kind of racial animus that drove this, are indeed actionable under 1983. And this court certainly suggested that in the Shea case and explicitly indicated that supported a cause of action in the Progress Development Corporation versus Mitchell case. So I don't concede that the filing of those cases is insufficient to state a 1983 claim.
But in this sense, you're just asserting the rights of the tenants, not any rights of your client.
No, we are.
It's an equal protection claim.
I'm
right?
Sorry. I didn't mean to interrupt you, Your Honor. We are asserting the rights of our own client, New West. New West has the right to pursue a claim under either 1983 or 1982 or under the Fair Housing Act for its own injury.
For its equal protection violation? In what sense does it have a racial identity?
No, it doesn't need a racial identity. If in fact the actions taken against the protected class cause injury to a third party like New West.
It has to be an injury related to the nature of the interest invaded. And if the claim is an equal protection claim, then that's a claim that lies with the tenants.
There can be instances where a defendant discriminates against a member of a protected class and causes injury to a third party. There is
your brief asserts that and says it's established, and then it cites one decision of a single district court. Is there any case that actually establishes this proposition?
Yes, there are several. The Arlington Heights case establishes that. The Bay Tree case in the 11th Circuit establishes that. The Cutting case in the First Circuit.
What case is that? Is this a case cited in your brief?
Yes, they are, Your Honor. The Progress Development Corporation case takes that position in the Seventh Circuit. In short, there's significant authority for those propositions. I see that my 1 minute light has come on. I'd like to reserve the remainder of my time for rebuttal, if I may.
Mr. Silverman.
Thank you, Your Honor. Good morning. My name is Peter Silverman, and I represent the appellee, the City of Joliet. I'd like to address the contention that the lawsuits were shams. I believe it's of record that one of the lawsuits was settled for over $400,000.
Which lawsuits? Mm-hmm. There are, I should, by my count, we've got at least five lawsuits now.
Yes, Your Honor. There was a lawsuit that was filed by the City of Joliet for past due amounts that were owed by New West for security and other costs. And New West was obligated.
I don't understand. What do you mean security and other costs?
We provided services to New West. They were obligated to reimburse us.
Contract action?
Yes, for costs associated with the operation of the project. I believe that's one of the lawsuits that now is contended to be a sham lawsuit, and it was settled. I believe that is.
If it was settled, as you say, on terms that the city was a prevailing party, it obviously wasn't a sham. The argument that I heard from Mr. Hecht is that there are building code or housing code enforcement actions that are asserted to be shams. Now, what's their status?
Your Honor, I don't believe there's any real contention, and I don't believe there's any support in the record that there are not housing code violations. They're on appeal, the lawsuit. There is.
You agree that they have never been addressed on the merits by the state court?
That is correct, Your Honor. New West has attempted to stay the actions, and that was denied. There is a contention that Joliet has exaggerated building code violations, but I don't believe anyone can seriously contend that there are not building code violations. There clearly are. And
I assume building codes are written in such a way that there are building code violations in all buildings all the time.
There are building code violations, and then there are building code violations. And this is not a safe place to live, and I believe the record supports that. There is a contention that we had.
Yes, are you referring to this project or the City of Joliet?
This project specifically, Your Honor. Joliet is a wonderful place to live. And Joliet is committed to providing safe and affordable housing. It just has to be safe housing, and that is not the situation at Evergreen Terrace. We are not motivated by making a profit, unlike the owner here. And this is a very unusual case for an owner who is seeking to earn huge amounts of money from HUD through fiscal incentives to contend that there's fair housing violations.
Well, what's your take on this? As counsel says, in 2004 and 2005, things were fine with respect to the condition of the building.
Your Honor, it's just not accurate, and it's not supported by the record. As I said, there is a contention, and there is a legitimate dispute whether some of the housing code violations are exaggerated, and there is something in the record to suggest that they were overstated. But there is, I'm not sure what counsel was referring to about a clean bill of health. I'm unaware of that being supported by the record. I do not think that that's accurate. If I may.
But to you, an overstatement to him is a shame.
I understand. I believe that is not a fair way to characterize this. I have not heard them characterize it as a sham before this moment. And I think what they're referring to are these lawsuits. And I just think it's inconceivable that you could, under the law, refer to those cases as a sham. They're well-based in fact and law. Their position is that we brought them because we were trying to have them spend more money. There's no basis whatsoever for that conclusion. Your Honor, in terms of the condemnation action, and you asked a question early on about why the condemnation action did not go first, that is what we've been trying to accomplish since the beginning. Now, we think that logically we have an action, we're trying to condemn the property.
Did you ask the district court to resolve the condemnation action first and put this case on hold?
We have filed, yes, Judge, we've filed various motions asking that briefing of the supremacy clause be stayed so that it can be addressed in the condemnation action. And there's several reasons why that's the appropriate way for this to be handled.
I'm not sure that you answered the question I asked.
I tried to. I
asked the district court to resolve the condemnation action on the merits and put all of these matters on hold.
No, I don't believe we did that. What we did do, Judge, is the reason that the cases overlap is because of the supremacy clause. And there's a contention that we don't have the power to condemn and that our sovereign right is preempted by federal law. And we felt that that was a threshold issue and it should be resolved in the condemnation action.
I don't understand that at all. When the United States removed the condemnation action, what was its position? We've got an empty chair problem
well,
here.
Well, Your Honor, they are party to the condemnation action. It's a different party. Well, as I understand it, Your Honor, HUD is now a party. They were not at the time that the case was removed. Jenny May was named. They had an interest in the property, or we thought so at the time. Ultimately, HUD has filed an answer in the condemnation action. And it is exhibit, Your Honor, I believe their general position is that we do not have the authority to take this property. And we understand that their position, and what we ask for is the opportunity to adjudicate that in the condemnation action. All of the issues that are raised concerning what our powers are and what the interest of the federal government is in this property are preserved in the condemnation action. They have filed an affirmative defense based on the supremacy clause. And there's all kinds of constitutional protections that are afforded to them.
I don't even understand what you're meaning when you say they've filed a defense based on the Supremacy Clause. The Supremacy Clause means that federal law preempts state law, but the defense is not based on the Supremacy Clause. It's presumably based on some statute. Now, what statute is it that, according to HUD, prevents the state from condemning a federally subsidized project?
I believe it. I don't know of a specific statute that they cite to. They claim that there's a conflict preemption. They cite to the federal government's interest.
Well, fine. When you say conflict preemption, that means there is some federal statute with which the condemnation action conflicts.
It's not our position. I oppose that position,
and
I don't believe
they have. Presumably they have cited something which we might go look at.
Your Honor, they have not, and our position is that as a matter of law there is no conflict. There's absolutely nothing that we're aware of or that's cited that show any intent by Congress to preempt here. There's no statute.
I'm not really interested in the contents of people's heads, but I'm very interested in the contents of the United States Code. And I hope perhaps both parties could let us know, perhaps by a supplemental letter after oral argument, what statute is being relied on for the proposition that federal law precludes the condemnation action. I think that might help us understand what's going on here.
They do not cite to a statute. They generally talk about the Fair Housing Act. They do not cite to a statute. The Fair Housing Act does not preclude condemnation, Your Honor. All I can say is that we're responding to their position, and we don't think it's well-based. But they have raised it in the condemnation action, and I believe it should be adjudicated there. They raise other defenses as well, similar to what they're raising in this court, that we don't have a proper purpose to take the property, that we're doing something that's improper. All of those issues can be litigated there, and that's been our position since the beginning. And we have raised it with the district court. It happened to be the same court that was presiding over the condemnation action as well. Your Honor, you mentioned something about the equal protection argument. That clearly is an indirect claim, a third-party claim that they're bringing on behalf of the tenants. It's always been
described. What do you think is the upshot of Sullivan against Little Hunting Park on this issue?
Judge, I don't know. I'm not familiar
with it. It was cited in their brief. It may be the single most important Supreme Court case on this question.
I apologize. I don't know. I do believe that for them to be able to state an equal protection claim on their own behalf, it has to be in the context of a class of one, which they have not alleged. And the claim is solely and specifically on behalf of the tenants, as are the 1982 claims. And when you look at the complaint, there is this merging of direct claims and indirect claims, and it's unclear often what they're asserting. But, Your Honor, when you ask questions about what is the concrete action directed at the tenants, is something that we've been trying to flesh out for some time, because if you read a complaint, there's absolutely nothing that's alleged specifically. They talk about a campaign of harassment, but they don't say what it is. There's no tenant.
Well, I think we've learned today what it is. The only thing in the campaign of harassment that Mr. Heck could articulate was that the tenants have been told that the city is bringing condemnation action.
Well, that is my understanding. I do know that in the complaint...
That's the campaign, beginning to end. And I asked Mr. Hecht as many times as I could think of to be concrete, and that's all he came up with.
In terms of the so-called discrimination claims that they've asserted, the claims are entirely third-party claims, and we believe that they fail, as the district court has found, for prudential standing reasons. There's no tenant involved in this case. There's no complaint by any tenant. If there was a basis for a complaint, it would belong to the tenants, and they could have easily asserted it. A lot of these cases that I've read involve perhaps a developer, but also individuals who are joined as well. And I believe that they are not in the proper position to be asserting claims on behalf of tenants.
Let's just take their own claims. The district court said that New West could not litigate any claim under the Fair Housing Act, even if it was a claim personal to it, because it was in the nature of a claim for preemption, and therefore would be logically a defense to an action filed in state court. Now, the Supreme Court has said that that's true in private litigation, but not true in litigation against a state actor, because 1983 creates the claim in federal court to enforce things that otherwise look like preemption. And that's the clear holding of Golden State Transit Corporation against Los Angeles, which the district judge didn't discuss and your brief doesn't discuss. And do you have anything to say about how your position could be reconciled with Golden State Transit?
Your Honor, I understand that there's a line of cases that where federal jurisdiction is conferred in the event...
Not a question of federal jurisdiction. Any case under 1983, there's federal jurisdiction under 1331 and 1343.3. This is a question about whether there is a particular right of action, and that was resolved by Maine against Thibodeau. And then the question was whether that could be applied to things that look like preemption. And Golden State Transit answered yes.
Your Honor, I'm sorry, I'm confused because I know you mentioned the Fair Housing Act, and I don't believe that there was any preemption found by the district court as to that issue. So I'm sorry, I am not following.
The two sides here keep talking about the Supremacy Clause as if it had any significance. The only significance of the Supremacy Clause is that that's why federal statutes preempt state statutes. When somebody makes an argument based on the Supremacy Clause, he is making an argument based on a federal statute. The plaintiff's argument here is based on the Fair Housing Act, which is a federal statute. Under 1983 in Maine against Thibodeau, claims based on federal statutes can be enforced in federal court against state actors, your clients. And Golden State Transit holds that that's true even though the federal claim is something that, if in state court, would be in the nature of a defense. Now, the district court threw this case out largely because, in the district court's view, there was no difference between public and private actors. That if this were a suit against a private actor, it would be thrown out because you can't make preemption arguments in federal court. Golden State Transit holds otherwise for public actors. And the question I'm asking is, do you have any response to Golden State Transit that might defend the district court's judgment? Because your brief doesn't make it, and I'm wondering whether you've got one now.
No, Judge, I really must not understand, because I do not believe that the district court's opinion, for the most part, involves preemption. I believe as to the discrimination claims, that's not an issue, that there was a lack of standing, a prudential standing. So I'm sorry, I don't understand.
No question of standing in this case.
Well,
standing deals with injury in fact and redressability. Your adversary claims injury in fact and claims damages, which are redress the loss of income from having fewer tenants. Standing is pellucid.
Judge, the real claim that they bring is on behalf of tenants, and the district court found that they didn't have standing to bring the claims on behalf of the tenants. When you read through the complaint, there is a merging of direct claims and the...
As I say, standing is pellucid. There is no problem, no conceivable problem with standing. The problem with action on behalf of the tenants is A, they're not acting on behalf of the tenants, they're acting on behalf of themselves from having less income. The problem is the injury is derivative. Now, that's why I asked about Sullivan against Little Hunting Park, because it looks to me like Sullivan against Little Hunting Park holds that even though your injury is derivative from wrongs done to others, if you suffer real injury yourselves, you're entitled to sue. But it has nothing whatsoever to do with standing.
Well, Your Honor, in terms of the 1983 case, I believe that the claim is clearly fatal under Monell. In terms of the case that you cite, I apologize. I'm just not familiar with it, so I can't answer. If the court does not have additional questions, I appreciate it. Thank you.
Thank you. Anything further, Mr. Hecht?
Yes. Three quick points, Your Honor.
And then I'll sit down. Judge Williams, this just clarifies one of your points, one of your questions that you asked. Every case, every one of the sham transactions was filed after this case was initiated in the spring of 1985. The three cases that are implicated in this, the three state cases, were all filed
When you say three, is it a total of three state cases in addition to the condemnation action?
Yes, it is.
Now, Mr. Silverman said that one of those three cases has been settled. Is that true?
That is correct.
So there are two pending state cases?
No, I'm sorry, Your Honor. There is yet another state case.
The number keeps going up. So there are now six cases.
Now, there are three housing violation
actions in state court. There was one contract action in state court. There was one condemnation action in state court removed. That's five. And this action, that's six.
Are there any more? No, I don't think there are any more. I think you have one too many. We've got a demolition proceeding and two code proceedings now consolidated and on appeal. You have the eminent domain proceeding, and you have this action, and you have the settled contract action. Those are the actions that are implicated here. And actually, the settled one is really not part of that. But
I still think that's six. If there are housing code actions, one nuisance action, one contract action, one condemnation action, and this action, that's six.
It is six.
All right. So yeah. The three things that you're saying are sham proceedings are the two housing code actions,
yes,
and the nuisance action.
The demolition action, yes.
So that's the relief they seek in the action.
That's correct.
What is the theory of relief? I thought it was nuisance.
I think it's a little unclear. I think you're correct that that's how it ought to have been pleaded, but I think it's just a recitation of the kind of allegations that are in the eminent domain proceeding. Whether it characterized, I think it talks about
that. I'm completely lost. The only allegation one makes in an eminent domain proceeding is, we want the property, here's the money.
That's right.
You don't allege that it's in bad shape or anything like that. You just say, we want it.
That's what we believe. That's not the structure of the eminent domain proceeding. It is a diatribe. And it was designed to be a diatribe, because that's what would scare HUD from its effort to put Evergreen Terrace in place, to preserve that affordable housing.
I just had one factual question. So, have there been any attempts by the tenants of Evergreen Terrace to organize themselves?
I'm not aware of any. I don't know the answer to that one way or the other. And following up, Judge Easterbrook, we would be more than willing to submit to you in a letter, the statutory basis for the Supremacy Clause issues.
I appreciate it. Thank you.
Thank you.
The case is taken under advisement.